The full video of City Councilman Reggie Gaffney's run-in with police is out. Duval County schools warn test changes could lower our local graduation rate. And what is that Carvana thing along I-95? All your questions answered. Just some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and make sure to get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, Transforming the Lives of the Series Homeless. We'll tell you about the Sulzbacher Center's big event this month, Transformations. Plus, it's the introduction of a new publication here on the First Coast. We'll tell you about Salty at Heart, all of that ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome three all-stars to Studio 5. David Bauerlein is here from the Florida Times. Good morning, David. Claire Goforth, editor of Folio Weekly, joining us once again.
Good morning.
And Tim Gibbons, who edits the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Good to see you guys. Lots to discuss this week. Everything from changes in testing for schools that local officials say could force a plummet in local graduation rates. Testing for the St. John's River reveals a mixed bag for water quality. And more to talk about this morning. But our top story: the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office has released the full video of a controversial run-in that you've been hearing about. It has to do with a confrontation between city council members Reggie Gaffney and Katrina Brown with police officers over a traffic stop last month. Now, in the video, both Gaffney and Brown accused the police of racial profiling after officers pulled over Gaffney because his license plate was reported stolen. Gaffney has since apologized for the incident, although Councilwoman Brown has not. We're going to listen now to some audio of the confrontation between Gaffney, Brown, and the sergeant in charge. Take a listen.
Officer Smith is one of my best officers. In my absence, he's the acting sergeant, and I would not condone racial profiling on my squad. Okay?
This is how I felt tonight.
Okay. Feelings and facts are two different things.
So me and you... Let me tell you what I'm going to do.
What happens is we run tags as we drive. When he ran this gentleman's tag, it came back as stolen.
So y'all just end up driving that run, everybody tag it.
Yes.
But that's how we find stolen vehicles.
All right, we're going to begin the hour with a discussion of this incident and take your calls. The number to call us, 549-2937. And so there are two questions that arise with this incident that have come up a lot as we've discussed it. Question one that we've gotten a lot from listeners: why were police running Councilman Gaffney's tag to begin with? Were they racially profiling him? Question two: why did the councilman feel the need to throw his weight around and say things like, "Do you know who I am?" and so forth? The councilman, when they go through ethics training, the councilmen and women are prohibited. They're told they're prohibited from misusing their positions when they interact with law enforcement and saying things like, "Do you know I'm an elected official?" And so, Tim Gibbons, let's begin with you. Those are the two controversies, really, with regard to this incident.
I think, as a general note, anytime you find yourself saying the words, "You know who I am," you're probably not going down a good path at that point.
No matter what the situation.
No matter who you are. Because the worst answer is no, I have no idea who you are. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
This is an interesting situation because you have broader societal things plus the specific situation. And the idea of racial profiling and the idea of the relationship between the African-American community and the police here in Jacksonville and across the nation is a fraught issue.
Regardless.
Right. Which doesn't necessarily say anything about this particular traffic stop, where I think most people assume that, yes, cops do check license plates, but I've never had my license plate stolen. Was a month past renewing my car a couple years ago, got pulled over because a cop was behind me, and that's what they're looking for.
The head of the local FOP was on this show recently, Steve Zona, and Claire, he explained to us that police all day long, as they're driving around town, randomly run license plates. He said it was a perfectly innocent random check of a license plate. African Americans don't buy that. They believe that police profiled Councilman Gaffney because they saw a black man driving a car and that they intentionally ran his plate. So there are two competing narratives here, depending on the experiences in life you've had with law enforcement, unfortunately.
Yeah, there absolutely are. And while in this instance, it does seem pretty clear that based on the tag being reported stolen, the officer was well within his rights to pull them over, there is a bigger question here. And black people have long been complaining that they are subject to more police stops. And when the officer said to Gaffney to explain why he ran his tag, he said that it was the most violent neighborhood in Jacksonville. And that is probably true. Mm-hmm. But then you have to ask yourself, if merely being present in a neighborhood where the rate of violence is higher, and that also happens to intersect with a neighborhood that where the population is largely African American, merely being present in a neighborhood where the majority of African American gives you a much greater chance of being pulled over by police. So in that way, there is an argument to be made that there's something wrong with how police enforcement is affecting the black population.
It's 549-2937 to join us. And there's a lot of context to this story, David Bauerlein. To be clear, Councilman Gaffney has apologized for behaving, as you see in the video, for being, you know, imperious or whatever with the police officer and saying, I'm going to call the sheriff and do you know who I am and all that kind of stuff. But as Tim pointed out, there's so many layers to this. He's a public official. He has power. There are issues of race. This is a complex situation, and it's one that it's a local story, but it brings to light complex issues we're seeing all over the country right now, frankly.
Well, sure. I mean, it's obviously perceptions, reality, and the old saying that perceptions can be reality.
Yeah.
It does seem like this was a lawful stop. There does not seem to be any dispute that the officers were abusing their power in this particular case by making this stop. They had authority to do so. That is how you find people who are driving stolen vehicles. Then you get to the issue of the do you know who I am, which is something that, quite frankly, that's not something that's racially based. I mean, people in power do that no matter what their race is. They've seen that happen in cities small and large where somebody gets pulled over and says, basically, you should consider who you're talking to before you go forward with doing whatever you're planning to do.
What I find interesting is I think that you can have things that seem competing that actually are both true. So it is possible that it is true that police officers randomly check license plates. It's also true that they can that random selection can be influenced by racial profiling. I obviously don't know in this case if that happened, but the idea that it
both things
both
are
things
in fact
true.
Yeah. Right. All right. Let's go to your calls. It's our media roundtable. The top stories of the week with David Bauerlein, Tim Gibbons, and Claire Goforth all joining the show today. 549-2937. Timmy is on the south side. Hi, Timmy. Good morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I guess I have two things. Okay, so if they are running plates and for stolen cars, and let's say they don't come into a stolen car but a guy that has a bench warrant, how does that play? Because if you weren't looking for a bench warrant, you were looking for a stolen plate. And my thing is, someone says that's legal, but I guess search and seizure comes to mind for me. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. And number two, to me, whenever there is something that a police officer says, it holds more weight than anything else. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and I've had cases where at 18 years old, I was with a bunch of my wrestling teammates, and it was about eight of us. And the St. Louis County Police comes over, and they stop us because we were hanging out waiting on some other guys. And I was the only person searched. You know, so to me, racial profiling occurs, but it appears that America doesn't want to face that fact that true racial profiling occurs, police brutality occurs, and good police officers get lumped with bad police officers because they stand and watch our civil liberties abuse. And, you know, you can say it's a good stop, but how is just running randomly, running place a good stop? Because what isn't that searching?
You know what? I appreciate the call. And if you're a first-year law student, you can sit and debate the Fourth Amendment. You can sit and debate search and seizure all night long, and I know they sit and do that. It is subject to interpretation is the short answer, unfortunately. Tim.
And going on the legal path, there's the old saying, you know, hard cases make bad laws. The idea that if you want to have a conversation about racial profiling and police interactions with African Americans, having a council person who I think we all probably assume did not actually have his plate stolen and was trying to get out of a red light ticket. This is a hard case to seize on and say the police acted inappropriately in running a plate when it unveiled this situation.
I think this has been enlightening for a lot of people to realize that this is a very common procedure for the police.
Also, I didn't know that you could report your plate stolen if you got a red light camera. So that was enlightening for me. I learned something from that standpoint that if I ever get...
But I think the sheriff's review found that it was something to do with some unpaid tolls in Central Florida. And it was just almost a comedy of errors in terms of how this all played out. But, you know, the whole issue of randomly searching or checking plates. I mean, if my car is stolen, I would certainly expect the sheriff's office or law enforcement to be out there looking for my car. How else are they going to find it other than checking plates and seeing whether this is a car that's reported stolen?
From the perspective of the police, this is how they are probably clearing up old cases, maybe, you know, tracking down leads. I'm sure there are a lot of threads there.
Even the caller's question on, you know, bench warrants of there's a real problem of people getting shot because they have a warrant for, you know, unpaid traffic tickets. But that doesn't say that we shouldn't have police searching for people who have warrants. It's a tough situation.
Andy is downtown. Hi, Andy.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this probably wouldn't be an issue if the council member hadn't broken the law in reporting his plate stolen to get out of tickets that he got. And yes, I mean, anybody who drives a vehicle should understand and use common sense in knowing that, yes, every time you drive down a road and there's a police officer driving past you, next to you, behind you, assume that he's running your plate. Assume that he's looking at you. There may be a call out for a similar vehicle to yours in that neighborhood. That's just the world we live in. And frankly, I'm tired of this woe is me bullshit. I'll take your comments off there.
Oh, I did not get the chance to press the delay button on that. Is a first. The first time in 8 years somebody has dropped a curse word on this program. Sorry, listeners.
Wait, we can't say...
blanket apology, First Coast. Matt is downtown. Hi, Matt. Good morning.
Well, how do I follow that?
I know you'll do well. Go ahead.
Jeez. So basically, I just wanted to tell a really short story. I'm from a place in Texas. And the demographics there are brown or white. There's hardly any black people in the entire town. The brown people, like myself, would get pulled over all the time by police. And then whenever I came to Jacksonville, I'd met some friends, and they told me, you know, you don't have to worry about getting pulled over by the police because to them, you look white. And it was a known fact, like, amongst these friends of mine, that's just the way it was in Jacksonville. And I can feel that same way whenever I go back to Texas. I was pulled over 30 times in 3 years, right? I was arrested 7 times on warrants for tickets that I got. Like, it was systematic and it was done on purpose, and I've seen it before. And then whenever I come here and I get the privilege of looking white comparatively, like, I see that problem just way worse here because it's like, it's just common knowledge. It's okay. In Texas, no one believed me, you know, until my dad actually got pulled over driving my car. Did anyone believe me? So I just wanted to point that out, that this happens, and it doesn't matter if you're a city council person or, you know, like, even if he did do that with his license plate, like, how big a deal is that really? Like, I don't see the, you know, that's a dangerous neighborhood, and now they're going to tie up all their hands with this. Like, if it's truly that dangerous of a neighborhood and that's what's really going on, give them a citation, let them go on and handle it later while you apparently attend to a war zone, okay? So that's all I have to say.
Thanks for that, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, random enforcement of laws by running police, by running tags, is something that people have questioned whether or not it's really an effective way to combat crime. I will say that I think most of us have a hard time believing that Councilman Gaffney could have actually forgotten going to the station and reporting his tag stolen. But like the caller says,
yeah, that's perhaps, come up a lot as well. Yeah.
Perhaps it doesn't make him public enemy number one. I did wonder about Steve Zona continuing to insist that Katrina Brown resign if she won't apologize merely for showing up and offering to serve as a witness. I mean, she may have been a bit incensed at times, but she never seemed to cross the line of the law, and I did take issue with that.
Here's a tweet from your colleague at the Times Union, David. Christopher Hong tweets the show. The officer mentioned that part of town being violent when explaining why three police were present, not why he ran their tags. And a tweet from Robin. I did a police ride along years ago and witnessed the officer running random checks of the license tags of vehicles in front of us. Standard operating procedure.
What's interesting about what I like about the show, you had your last two callers were like embodied the debate of the guy who...
Different points of view.
The guy who said, you know, he's done with the whiny BS, focus on counterperson who possibly lied about having his tag stolen. Then you have the guy from Texas who basically, no, this is a thing that happens and shouldn't.
Carista, Intercoastal West. Hi, Carista.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
So I wanted to call in this morning and just kind of give a story. We are a middle-class white family. We were traveling in Orlando, and we were pulled over for no reason, no apparent reason, at a stoplight. It turns out our tag was not registered to the vehicle we were driving. And the dealers had made an error 2 years prior when we traded in our car. So for 2 years, we were driving a car with the wrong tag. At the traffic light, an officer was randomly running tags, looked at our car, not the car it was registered to, pulled us over. So he was doing his job. All of these people complaining about officers pulling people over for randomly running tags should have their car stolen and then not complain when officers don't find it because they're not going to run tags. How does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks for that, Carista. Yeah. Thanks for providing that context as well. Interesting. Harmon on the north side. Hello.
Melissa, good morning. Good to speak with you and the gang again.
You too.
Well, I'm African-American, black, whatever you want me to be. I'm poor. I don't mind being middle class, rich, or that kind of thing. I don't have a dog to defend in this argument, but it sounds like I heard one of the reporters say they were running the tag because they were in a poor community or a crime-infested community. But me, I try and be the voice of reason and data. And along with, I would imagine and I would expect for the police to run your tag, but what I think is missing from my analyzation was Councilman Gaffney the only car on the road, or was Councilman Gaffney and other cars on the road? And out of three cars, for a hypothetical, why was that particular one car pulled over? Was it because it was old or it didn't fit the crime?
No, I think it's according to the police, it's because the tag came up stolen. And as the previous caller just told us, their random run of her tag showed that her family's car didn't fit her license plate. So that's what, you know, you know what I mean?
Right. And what I'm trying to convey, Melissa, say if you had a Mercedes on the road, you had a Hootie, I guess, an old collectible, and you have a van, I guess the police computer can only run one tag at a time. So as the policeman, which out of the three would you choose to run? What profile would you use, whether you're going to run the Mercedes, the van, or the Hootie? How do you choose which vehicle I'm going to run?
I hear you, Harmon.
That would be my question. But, yeah, I would expect the police to run tags, and I expect that, hey, whenever I see an officer behind me, a couple cars behind me, if he follows you for a block or two, guess what? Your tag is being read.
Thanks, Harmon. Okay, and lots of folks waiting on hold to comment on this one. But we do need to move on and talk about some other news and notes from the week. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. The number to join the show as we move forward with some other headlines, 549-2937. And also making news this week, Florida's school board is considering raising testing standards for high school graduation. But here in Duval, district leaders warn that could result in plummeting graduation rates. In fact, local graduation rates could fall by 10 percentage points, and the rate among African-American students even further could fall by 16 points if the changes are approved, district leaders say. Currently, nearly 80% of local seniors graduate on time, including 75% of African-American seniors. The rates have really ticked upward in recent years, but the local school board says what the state board is doing is going to throw a fly in the ointment, a monkey in the wrench, to quote one of my favorite movies, Die Hard. Not good news, in other words. Claire, go forth. Your thoughts.
Yeah, you know, graduation rates falling does affect people's ability to succeed after high school. I do know that there are many schools in Duval County that are failing grades or are at risk of being closed and turned into charter schools. And it does seem very logical that the students that will be affected most by this change will probably are more likely to have attended those schools. It also seems likely that the students affected by this change will be more likely to be poor and less likely to be white. So, you know, we make these sweeping changes. Some students are going to get swept aside.
Yeah. And the big complaint that local school boards consistently seem to have is that the state keeps constantly moving the goalposts, constantly making changes to standards and testing. And every time local districts try to catch up, they change it again. And so that's been a running narrative here.
It's one of the frustrations in talking about something like this, where you can get into a philosophical conversation about what does it mean to graduate? And if you're saying that this is the bar and they've set the bar here, well, yes, some students will get certificate of completions because they've not hit that bar, and that's okay because this is where the bar is, except that that bar keeps on moving. And it becomes difficult to almost evaluate any individual thing because you have the backdrop of, wait, you know, we're not done with last year's changes yet.
Right, exactly.
And I think, too, there's this issue that if you there's real people involved with this. If you are not able to graduate with a diploma, it's harder for you to find a job.
Yeah.
It's harder to get into the military. That really affects the rest of your life. And there's also the issue of, should a test be the decision maker on that, or don't teachers, schools themselves have a role in deciding, yes, you are worthy of graduating and moving on to the next stage in your life.
There's so much tension here. Local school boards feel that local control is being taken away from them. They're considering suing the state over this other piece of legislation that gives more autonomy and funding to charter schools. Now there's this battle regarding testing standards and graduation. And not only that, how about the fact that here in Duval County, they were so excited about the fact that graduation rates, you know, they'd been in the toilet for years and years, and they were finally now starting to go in the right direction. What about that?
And that's that change in goalpost thing. I mean, you look at, so the two tests they have to take, one of them is the Algebra 1, you know, end of course sort of thing. And there's discussion, if you read Chronicle of Education, about there's a push to remove algebra requirements from some from like community colleges, with the idea being algebra just kicks a lot of people out of the educational system, and depending on what you're doing, you don't need it. But we tend not to have a conversation at that level of, should we just not have this test?
It's 549-2937 to join us. John is in Riverside right now. Hey, John. Good morning.
Hey, everybody. How's everyone doing this morning?
Good, thanks.
Looks like we have some fun comments today.
Yeah, I'd say so. That's a good way to put it. I hope I'm not fired after one of them. I just didn't get to the dump button just quick enough. It's been a long week, you know, and I didn't have enough coffee this morning. What can I say?
So, listen, one of the things that I experienced in Europe, in Germany, for instance, I went to school throughout the world. I've gone to school in Asia and in Europe as a young man, was their system where kids that were beginning to enter high school were tested for kind of, they kind of discover what people were good at. If you were good at metalworking, they would divert you into vocational school. So by the time you started high school, you weren't pursuing academic pursuits because, you know, maybe that's not what your talent or skill is. You know, we have to be very careful about Common Core and about these rigid, blocked mechanisms of determining the success of people. Graduating people from high school is completely useless, especially in a global competitive economy where the Chinese and other people are incredibly ahead of us in terms of really pushing education. So we've forgotten some of the basics. The basics are people are good at certain areas. Why not begin to offer them these things early? In Jacksonville, you have one vocational high school. I mean, come on. This is a huge place. You have one vocational high school, and you have dropout rates and whatnot that are through the roof. No one's pursuing these. I don't think they are.
Right.
Looking at how can we offer people an opportunity to learn a trade, a guild, if you will, so they can become the best at that particular trade. I don't care if it's janitorial services. I mean, if somebody really knows what they're doing, I know how marble is. I know the perfect is stuff to use on marble, whatever it is. If you become the best and really good at what you do, you can be successful and make money and have a happy life. I mean, it's absurd that the only benchmark and measure of our GDP progress is a high school graduation rate. It really, to me, is meaningless because these people aren't really doing what they want to do or what they're capable of doing because we're not offering that to them anymore.
Yeah.
It's just pure boxed academics. I think it's insane. That's my comment, and I'll take any rebuttals out the air.
Thank you, John. Previous Superintendent Nicolae Vidi, who's now up in Detroit, he tried to expand vocational education in Duval County, at least somewhat. But what about John's point? Well, could it be expanded more?
From a business standpoint, there's a huge need for skilled tradesmen. Manufacturing is no longer a low-skilled job, but it's not necessarily something you need a college degree for exactly. But there is a need for those type of people who do those jobs. The problem that as the caller mentioned, like, you know, the German system where you have Gymnasium and Realschule and Hauptschule, you end up with having to tell somebody in, you know, eighth or ninth grade, this is your path in life. And can you imagine Duval County telling a kid as they finish middle school, okay, you don't get to go to the good high school? There'd be riots.
Well, it's a cultural thing. I think, Tim, you're right. In this country, in European countries, it's more accepted. Yeah. And also, my stepmom, she used to be married to a man who ran a company. He was an executive in Dayton, Ohio at NCR, National Cash Register, which has since gone out of business. But anyway, years ago, they sent him to run the NCR in Australia, Sydney, Australia, right? They went down there, and in Australia, that's how they do the schools. So in seventh grade, my stepmom's kids, who are now my step-siblings, that's what they did with her kids, okay? In sixth or seventh grade, they just told the kids, this is what you're good at, and this is what you're going to do. And in Australia, everybody just kind of goes, okay. And so my stepbrother, one of my stepbrothers, is now a hydrogeologist in Colorado.
And he wants to be a poet?
and he's making, by the way, he's making a lot of money in the fracking boom, which it's good timing for him. But he became a hydrogeologist because in Australia, they kind of put him on that track. I have no idea how it happened. But it's a cultural thing.
Well, I was going to say, in America, you go to college, and that's where you make that choice. Right. And maybe you go to a four-year degree, or maybe it's a two-year. But if you don't have that high school diploma, you're foreclosed from moving there. So I think this probably would be a good idea to have more vocational type of jobs where you graduate from high school.
Different types of high school diplomas. I mean, I know, you know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and at one period you could basically get a like administrative high school diploma, a college high school diploma, or like a vocational high school. They were all high school diploma, but different requirements.
In this country, every parent thinks their child is brilliant and special. They wouldn't be able to handle their kid being told, you're going to go take shop and be a tradesman.
We all live in Lake Wobegon.
We're all snowflakes.
That's right.
You know, when we do create an educational system, we're saying that these are the fundamental things that you need to know. If we take some of those things off of the curriculum, then students are going to graduate without that knowledge. And I mean, that we can argue about whether or not that's appropriate.
Peter is in Arlington. Hello, Peter.
Yes, good morning. I have the issue with the testing, and because of my family's been affected by that, my son, not because of his grades, but because of testing, has been held back twice already, and he's in the 8th grade. So what happens if he misses the test, you know, one or two more times? He'll be 20 and still in high school. Is the state prepared for that? And I definitely do advocate or appreciate that vocational schools, and I do wish Jacksonville had more, because I have a feeling that's going to be the future for my son. He's not a scholar.
Yeah. And, you know, Peter, in this state and really in a growing number of states, there are a number of parents joining legal and just grassroots pushback to standardized testing. That's just something we're following here in our newsroom.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that. Thank you.
Sarah, Intercoastal West. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Yes, I had a comment about, I had a question actually. Who wants all this testing? Pearson? Who's whispering in senators' ears or you know, Department of Education's ears and taking them to lunch and maybe vacations? Because Pearson and Hutton Miffin and McGraw-Hill and all these people, they're making boatloads of money on these tests.
Not that Tim Gibbons is cynical in any way, but a cynic might say, follow the money.
They just do it out of the goodness of their heart. They just take senators to lunch because they like having lunch with them.
It's for the children, Tim.
Well, I mean, there are two competing explanations, Sarah. One is that testing brings accountability and helps kids compete in a global economy. The other darker explanation is that there is a profit motive and that people are making money off these the massive deployment of testing in our schools. Right, David?
I think there's an argument certainly to be made there. But, you know, the other argument would be it's okay, keep the same standards in place and go for 100% graduation rate. If you want to measure accountability, that's the way to do it. But they keep changing the tests, and maybe there is more money to be made in changing tests and changing formats and, you know, out with the old, in with the new, and there's more money to be made in that.
I also think your caller had an interesting point there, though. So he has a son who's failed the test twice. At some point, whatever we do, you know, broadly, the idea of saying, okay, this path isn't working, let's find a path that works for the child, versus saying, guess you don't graduate, that doesn't seem to be what we want as a society.
We're getting an email about this from Linda. The point is to grind down opposition to charter schools and make public schools unattractive. This will continue the push towards privatization. Look at the money flow. It is about eliminating a permanent underclass of kids without an advanced degree. Wow. Okay. Speaking of money, have you noticed that car vending machine looking thing? It's this big tower along I-95 just north of JTB. It's from a company called Carvana. This caught my eye in the Business Journal this week. Stacked inside the glass and steel structure are about 30 vehicles and the potential to disrupt the traditional dealership model that has dominated car sales for generations. Tim Gibbons, what is Carvana all about?
It is the structure that we've probably gotten the most calls about. What the heck is that?
Yes!
They call it a car vending machine. It's a little bit of a misnomer. It's not like you can actually go up and just buy a car. They have an interesting radio ad, actually, that makes it kind of sound like that. But basically, you buy your car online and you pick it up there. To some extent, that tower serves its purpose by having us talk about it. It's almost like a billboard in a way.
Exactly.
But they're really looking to disrupt the auto industry.
And so it's like CarMax, but the whole sell is that vertical tower is so eye-catching that you're more likely to buy from Carvana?
You're more likely to know about them. And this gets a little bit into the weeds, but the construction cost of that is far lower than the typical car dealership. So at least theoretically, they have a lower operating cost for them to do their business. So they could sell cars for a little bit cheaper.
And, okay, this is the first of its kind in Florida,
it
right?
Is.
Why they choose Jacksonville?
Logistics. Basically coming, you know, as you're... You buy the cars online, they have to ship them in, and shipping things into Florida is easily done in Jacksonville. Their plan is to expand throughout the state.
Can you haggle over a price, or how does that work?
It's all through the website. So okay. At the point that you show up,
you've already
worked that out, yeah.
Interesting. So you're getting a lot of traffic on your website about this one.
I would suggest not kicking it if you don't get a car. It's not like a Coke machine where you can just, you know...
Check it out on the Business Journal website. And finally, it's our look at the strange, ridiculous, and just plain bizarre from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. And only in Florida do hurricanes wash ashore relics from the era of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yes, a 12-foot Cold War era Soviet buoy surfaced on Dania Beach in South Florida after Hurricane Irma, and local authorities think it may have come from Cuba. But based on the nation's historic relationship with Soviet-era Russia, Bill Moore, a maintenance mechanic with a local state park, spotted the buoy 2 days after Irma hit. He managed to drag the 1,200-pound buoy with rope and a skid steer loader to his office parking lot before the Coast Guard could get a hold of it. Moore suspects the drift, which reads Hydrometrical Service of the USSR in Russian on the side, likely floated 350 miles from Cuba. Meteorologists agree. Now, one word on the buoy literally translates into water measuring. Another says it has a lifting capacity of 6,600 pounds. This according to a Russian specialist with the Library of Congress. Buoys like the one found in South Florida are sometimes used to predict changes in the weather. They can also measure wave height, even predict natural disasters. And the historian suspects the one found down there in South Florida might have had a dual purpose dating back to Fidel Castro's rise to power in Cuba in the early 1960s. At the time, Russia provided aid to Cuba and used the neighboring country as a base to spy on the U.S.
I don't care what they say. This has something to do with the election.
Of course. And how about this one? Only in Florida does an old burglary have a happy ending thanks to the power of social media. Candace Murray had feared her precious memories were lost when her home was burglarized and her children's baby photos were stolen 10 years ago. Everything was either stolen or destroyed. But years later, a woman mysteriously left a box of baby photos, including ultrasounds, at the front desk of a newspaper, the News Herald in Panama City. The staff tried, but social media wasn't what it is now, and the trail grew cold. But recently, a reporter at the paper stumbled upon the box of photos. It was filled with clues, including the mother's hospital band. So they used Facebook to reach out to the mom. A dumbfounded Murray said her daughter graduated from high school last year, and the family had a difficult time finding the photos, but she rejoiced that the photos will be there when her 15-year-old son graduates. So that's kind of a cool story.
Yeah, coming soon. Cold Absolutely. Case, social media.
Thanks
a heartwarming tale.
Yes, it is. And thanks to our panel, David Bauerlein, Claire Goforth, and Tim Gibbons. Read them in their respective publications. Thanks for being here, you guys.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. And we'll be right back.
You're moving to the rock and sound. Hey everyone, Chris Thiele here to announce that A Prairie Home Companion kicks off this very weekend live from the Palace Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. What a start to the season we have with Chris Stapleton, Julian Baker, and the hilarious Lori Kilmartin, plus duets with Emily King and the best band in public radio, our birthday salute to musicians, our radio acting company, and I'm working on a brand new song of the week. We are so excited to be back. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Hey, Car Talk fans, if you're wondering why Click and Clack aren't here, NPR is no longer distributing the best of Car Talk. The good news is you can continue to listen to the podcasts of the program at cartalk.com. We hope you enjoy WJCT's new weekend schedule. For more information about the new programs, visit wjct.org/weekends. Exciting new changes are coming to your weekend. 89.9 WJCT has added Freakonomics Radio, Sunday afternoons at 1, followed by Planet Money and How I Built This at 2. For more information and to see the new weekend schedule, go to wjct.org/weekends.
Welcome back. Well, there are thousands of people in Jacksonville who have no one to turn to, no one who is able to help them when a crisis happens in their lives. They're one paycheck away, really, from being out on the streets. Every day, Sulzbacher Center is home to hundreds of homeless people in this community. Many of them are women and children. But Sulzbacher offers more than just a roof over their head and something to eat. It's a place for reinventing lives and restoring hope. Sulzbacher helps people in need find the way home. Next week, the Sulzbacher Center presents its 19th annual Transformations event as they transform lives. Darnell Smith is Transformations co-chair, and Eileen Briggs is Sulzbacher's chief development officer, and they're here to tell us more. Hey, guys, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Darnell Smith, of course, your market president for Florida Blue and such a beloved figure around town. Good to see you.
Good to see you, my friend.
We'll talk about the event in a moment, but first, let's talk about the fact that the Sulzbacher Center, if it weren't for the Sulzbacher Center in downtown Jacksonville, there would be so many more people suffering in this community. You know, just in such desperate straits.
Absolutely. So when you think about the work that we do, every day we shelter 360 men, women, and children. We provide health care to more than 200 people and meals to over 1,500 individuals. And so that's the work we do. We stand in the gap to make certain that our city is all about. We deliver. And without having organizations like the Sulzbacher Center, folks would certainly be without.
Yeah, absolutely. And Eileen Briggs, Sulzbacher, right in downtown Jacksonville, has been a presence for many years. What is exciting is that in recent years, you've also been focused on Sulzbacher Village, which, as I mentioned, the majority of people in this community who are homeless are women and kids. You're building a whole new community specifically for them. Isn't that right?
That's right, Melissa. We broke ground on our Sulzbacher Village for women and families. It's going to be in the Brentwood neighborhood over on 44th and Pearl. And what we're doing with this facility is expanding into permanent housing. Mm-hmm. So rather than emergency shelter, we will be providing 70 units of permanent, affordable housing. So we're really excited about that project. It's also going to have a pediatric clinic, which is new for us, and also an early learning center that will really be a model for the community.
That's where this is going, isn't it? Rather than just providing temporary shelter, when you look at solving the issue of homelessness, rapid rehousing, permanent housing is the answer.
Correct.
Right?
That's right. There's a model called the Housing First model. It's been around for many years. And what we found out over the last few decades of providing homeless assistance is that really the solution is housing. And rather than maintaining someone in a homeless state, which is what an emergency shelter does, if we can take that money and invest it into housing solutions, it really is a better way to care for these families and these individuals. And we've been doing that for many years, just with area landlords, working with landlords. And so now we're expanding into being a housing provider. It's really exciting.
And Darnell, it's not a handout. It works. When you get someone into permanent housing, they become a productive, tax-paying member of society.
You know, I think the tagline we utilize couldn't be more appropriate. Helping people to find their way home. And so as I think about, over 2,000 children in Jacksonville alone who are homeless, that just isn't us. And so it is all about helping these families, these children, be able to find their way home. And we've done a marvelous job in being able to ensure that they have all the services that they need in order to stand on their own again. People don't know and realize that more than 60% of the services that we provide now are toward health. And so our Transformations event is all about finding the heart in healthcare. So we provide things such as primary care, dental, vision, behavioral health, and these are much needed services in order for a family to be able to stand up again.
Okay. And it's easy to be a little part of helping make all of this possible. You just need to come on out to Transformations next Thursday. How can people be part of this?
So we want everybody to be there. It is fantastic. It is going to be a lot of fun. There's still tickets available. You can call us at the Sulzbacher Center, or you can go on our website and be able to get tickets. You're going to see a lot of folks there. This is what Jacksonville is all about, helping others to get to where they need to be. We've come a long way. This is our very, very important fundraiser. This is the one that helps us to be able to have the dollars necessary to ensure that we can operate. And we really need everyone's help. And we hope that everybody will take a moment and just join us.
That's right. It's the 19th annual, by the way, Transformations event for Sulzbacher Center. Next Thursday night, October 12th, at the Times Union Center. Get your tickets now at sulzbachercenter.org. Thanks so much, Darnell Smith. He's Transformations Co-Chair. Eileen Briggs, Chief Development Officer. SulzbacherCenter.org. And it's really one of the most, it just gets you right in the heart. One of those types of events on the calendar. And you go and you just really are moved by it. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you. And once again, it'll be a lot of fun.
So yeah, it's fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun that night.
All right. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
All right, and finally this hour, it's a brand new publication here on the First Coast with a mission to promote equality, sustainability, and also serve as a place for women to be heard. Salty at Heart features everything from women scientists and artists to humanitarians, environmentalists, surfers, and adventurers from all over the world. It is sea-inspired and dripping with art, stories, and interviews from people making a positive difference. Kirsten Thompson is editor and creator of Salty at Heart Journal, and she joins us now. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. This sounds really cool, and thanks for telling me about it. So how'd you come up with this?
The idea was really formed in my mind when I realized I was tired of the advertising and the films and the magazines that really promoted this objectification of women. And I wanted a space where I could read about the inspiring things that women were doing, where you could understand the compassion, the grit, the strength, and the intelligence of women, and really provide a space for that. And also I wanted to create a world where we could really promote the positive changes that people were doing. In society, we tend to focus a lot, for good reason, on all the doom and gloom and devastation, death and devastation. We hear that all the time when we turn on the news. It's really, really important to bring in the missing factor in the conversation, and that is empowerment and inspiration, and really allowing people to understand that in order to create change, we can't just have people shutting down, which is what's happening when they get overwhelmed. So we need to bring in this missing factor of inspiration, and you have to give people hope. And so I wanted to form a collection that sort of combined all of my passions for women empowerment, for sustainability, for surfing and adventure, and really combine that and connect the dots. As a writer, I'm very passionate about bringing together complex ideas and putting them together and really making it known that there's not one way of solving problems. You can bring in these diverse viewpoints and really create change in that way. And so I wanted to fill those two spaces, and not only that, but have a journal where you'd open it up and immediately it would tell you that you belong and you matter and you're important. And that's really important for women.
And by the way, this is inspired by the ocean too. That's why it's called Salty at Heart, which I like as well.
Yes, yes. The name was specifically chosen because we are all indeed connected to the ocean. So the journal is not just for surfers, for sailors, for water women, for watermen. It's for anyone, because if you look at this planet that we're living on, it is a water planet. We are so deeply ingrained in the ocean and what it provides us. And you know, with climate change, we have sea level rise. We have people being, communities being upended by the ocean. We rely on it for food and transportation. And so at the end of the day, we are all salty at heart. And that's the idea behind the name. So when you dive into this journal, it's not just talking about the ocean. It's talking about these issues
related to it. Mm-hmm. Now, you can get this at Barnes & Noble and Books A Million, right?
Yes, you sure can.
The bookmark in Neptune Beach.
Yes.
And you can go online at saltyatheart.com. So kudos, Kirsten.
Thank you.
From right here on the First Coast. Check it out, Salty at Heart Journal at saltyatheart.com. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Our podcast is up every day on iTunes and through our app. And our rebroadcast is on every night at 8. Up next on 1A, the Friday News Roundup. And be sure to tune into a brand new show today here on 89.9 and debuting on public radio all over the state, the Florida Roundup. I'll co-host this program along with Tom Hudson of WLRN in Miami, an up-to-the-minute look at stories and trends affecting the people of the Sunshine State as we take calls from listeners statewide, including here on the First Coast. It's the Florida Roundup every Friday at 1 here on 89.9. I'm Melissa Ross. So we'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. 1A is up next. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.